Side 3. The Bachman Books. 4 Early Novels. Continuing with Rage on page 73. Susan Brooks had put her head down on her desk, the way they used to make us do in kindergarten when it was nap time. She was wearing a powder blue scarf in her hair. It looked very pretty. My stomach hurt. Decker! I cried out and jerked the pistol around toward the windows. It was a state trooper with a battery-powered bullhorn. Up on the hill, the newsmen were grinding away with their cameras. Just grinding away. Pigpen hadn't been so far wrong at that. Come out, Decker, with your hands up. Let me be, I said. My hands had begun to tremble. My stomach really did hurt. I've always had a lousy stomach. Sometimes I'd get the dry heaves before I went to school in the morning, or when I was taking a girl out for the first time. Once Joe and I took a couple of girls down to Harrison State Park. It was July, warm and very beautiful. The sky had a dim, very high haze. The girl I was with was named Anne Marie. She spelled it all one name. She was very pretty. She wore dark green corduroy shorts and a silk pullover blouse. She had a beach bag. We were going down Route 1 toward Bath, the radio on and playing good rock and roll. Brian Wilson, I remember that. Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. And Joe was driving his old blue Mercury. He used to call it the Blue Frog, and then grin his Joe McKennedy grin. All the vents were open. I got sick to my stomach. It was very bad. Joe was talking to his girl. They were talking about surfing, which was certainly compatible with the Beach Boys on the radio. She was a fine-looking girl. Her name was Rosalind. She was Anne Marie's sister. I opened my mouth to say I felt sick and puked all over the floor. Some of it got on Anne Marie's leg, and the look on her face, you couldn't imagine it. Or maybe you could. They all tried to make light of it, brush it off. I let all my guys puke on me the first date, ha-ha. I couldn't go in swimming that day. My stomach felt too bad. Anne Marie sat on the blanket next to me most of the time and got a burn. The girls had packed a picnic lunch. I drank a soda, but I couldn't eat any of the sandwiches. I was thinking about Joe's blue Merc standing in the sun all day and how it was going to smell going home. The late Lenny Bruce once said, "You can't get snot off a suede jacket." And to that I would add one of the other great home truths. You can't get the smell of vomit out of a blue Mercury's upholstery. It's there for weeks, for months, maybe years. And it smelled just about like I thought it would. Everybody just pretended it wasn't there, but it was. Come on out, Decker. We're through fooling around with you. Stop it. Shut up. Of course they couldn't hear me. They didn't want to. This was their game. Don't like it so well when you can't talk back, do you? Ted Jones said. When you can't play any of your smart games. Leave me alone. I sounded suspiciously like I was whining. They'll wear you out, Pigpen said. It was the voice of doom. I tried to think about the squirrel and about the way the lawn grew right up to the building, no fucking around. I couldn't do it. My mind was jackstraws in the wind. The beach that day had been bright and hot. Everybody had a transistor radio, all of them tuned to different stations. Joe and Rosalind had body surfed in glass green waves. You've got 5 minutes, Decker. Go on out, Ted urged. He was gripping the edge of his desk again. Go out while you've got a chance. Sylvia whirled on him. What have you got to be, some kind of hero? Why? Shit, that's all you'll be, Ted Jones. I'll tell them. Don't tell me what... Wear you down, Charlie. Grind you, waiting. Decker! Go on out, Charlie. Please, can't you see you're upsetting him? Decker! PTA suppers and all that lousy. Cracking up if you just let him. Decker! Alone, grind you, wear you down. You go, Charlie. You can't... Don't want to be forced to shoot until you're ready. Leave him be, Ted. If you know what all of you... Shut up! Good for you! Come out! I swung the pistol up at the windows, holding it in both hands, and pulled the trigger 4 times. The reports slammed around the room like bowling balls. Window glass blew out in great crackling fistfuls. The troopers dived down out of sight. The cameramen hit the gravel. The clot of spectators broke and ran in all directions. Broken glass shone and twinkled on the green grass outside like diamonds on show window velvet. Brighter gems than any in Mr. Frankel's store. There was no answering fire. They were bluffing. I knew that. It was my stomach, my goddamn stomach. What else could they do but bluff? Ted Jones was not bluffing. He was halfway to the desk before I could bring the pistol around on him. He froze, and I knew he thought I was going to shoot him. He was looking right past me into darkness. Sit down, I said. He didn't move. Every muscle seemed paralyzed. Sit down. He began to tremble. It seemed to begin in his legs and spread up his trunk and arms and neck. It reached his mouth, which began to gibber silently. It climbed to his right cheek, which began to twitch. His eyes stayed steady. I have to give him that, and with admiration. One of the few things my father says when he's had a few that I agree with is that kids don't have much balls in this generation. Some of them are trying to start the revolution by bombing U.S. government washrooms, but none of them are throwing Molotov cocktails at the Pentagon. But Ted's eyes, even full of darkness, stayed steady. "Sit down," I repeated. He went and sat down. Nobody in the room had cried out. Several of them had put their hands over their ears. Now they took them away carefully, sampling the noise level of the air, testing it. I looked for my stomach. It was there. I was in control again. The man with the bullhorn was shouting, but this time he wasn't shouting at me. He was telling the people who had been watching from across the road to get out of the area and be snappy about it. They were doing it. Many of them ran hunched over, like Richard Widmark in a World War II epic. A quiet little breeze riffled in through the two broken windows. It caught a paper on Harmon Jackson's desk and fluttered it into the aisle. He leaned over and picked it up. Sandra Cross said, "Tell something else, Charlie." I felt a weird smile stretch my lips. I wanted to sing the chorus from that folk song, the one about beautiful, beautiful blue eyes, but I couldn't remember the words and probably wouldn't have dared anyway. I sing like a duck. So I only looked at her and smiled my weird smile. She blushed a little, but didn't drop her eyes. I thought of her married to some slob with 5 2-button suits and fancy pastel toilet paper in the bathroom. It hurt me with its inevitability. They all find out sooner or later how unchic it is to pop your buttons at the Sadie Hawkins dance, or to crawl into the trunk so you can get into the drive-in for free. They stop eating pizza and plugging dimes into the juke down at Fat Sammy's. They stop kissing boys in the blueberry patch. And they always seem to end up looking like the Barbie doll cutouts in Jack and Jill magazine, told in at slot A, slot B, and slot C. Watch her grow old before your very eyes. For a second, I thought I might actually turn on the waterworks. But I avoided that indignity by wondering if she was wearing white panties today. It was 10:20. I said... Chapter 22. I was 12 when Mom got me the corduroy suit. By that time, Dad had pretty much given up on me, and I was my mother's responsibility. I wore the suit to church on Sundays and to Bible meetings on Thursday nights, with my choice of 3 snap-on bow ties, rooty-toot. But I hadn't expected her to try and make me wear it to that goddamn birthday party. I tried everything. I reasoned with her. I threatened not to go. I even tried a lie, told her the party was off because Carol had the chicken pox. One call to Carol's mother set that straight. Nothing worked. Mom let me run pretty much as I pleased most of the time, but when she got an idea solid in her mind, you were stuck with it. Listen to this. For Christmas one year, my dad's brother gave her this weird jigsaw puzzle. I think Uncle Tom was in collusion with my dad on that one. She did a lot of jigsaws. I helped. And they both thought it was the biggest waste of time on earth. So Tom sent her a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle that had a single blueberry down in the lower right-hand corner. The rest of the puzzle was solid white, no shades. My father laughed his ass off. "Let's see you do that one, Mother," he said. He always called her Mother when he felt a good one had been put over on her, and it never ceased to irritate her. She sat down on Christmas afternoon and spread the puzzle out on her puzzle table in her bedroom. By this time, they each had their own. There were TV dinners and pick-up lunches for Dad and I on December 26th and the 27th, but on the morning of the 28th, the puzzle was done. She took a Polaroid picture of it to send to Uncle Tom, who lives in Wisconsin. Then she took the puzzle apart and put it away in the attic. That was 2 years ago, and so far as I know, it's still there. But she did it. My mother is a humorous, literate, pleasant person. She is kind to animals and accordion-playing mendicants. But you didn't cross her, or she could dig in her heels, usually somewhere in the groin area. I was crossing her. I was, in fact, starting to run through my arguments for the fourth time that day, but time had just about run out. The bow tie was clutching my collar like a pink spider with hidden steel legs. The coat was too tight, and she'd even made me put on my square-toed shoes, which were my Sunday best. My father wasn't there. He was down at Gogan's slopping up a few with his good buddies. But if he'd been around, he would have said I looked squared away. I didn't feel like an asshole. "Listen, Mother, I don't want to hear any more about it, Charlie." I didn't want to hear any more about it either, but since I was the one running for the Shithead of the Year award and not her, I felt obliged to give it the old school grunt. All I'm trying to tell you is that nobody is going to be wearing a suit to that party, Mom. I called up Joe McKennedy this morning, and he said he was just going to wear...
Just shut up about it,
she said very soft, and I did. When my mother says shut up, she's really mad. She didn't learn shut up reading The Guardian.
Shut up or you won't be going anywhere.
But I knew what that meant. Not going anywhere would apply to a lot more than Carol Granger's party. It would probably mean movies, the Harlow Rec Center, and swimming classes for the next month. Mom is quiet, but she carries a grudge when she doesn't get her way. I remembered the jigsaw puzzle, which had borne the whimsical title, Last Berry in the Patch. That puzzle had crossed her, and it hadn't been out of the attic for the last 2 years. And if you have to know, and maybe some of you do anyway, I had a little crush on Carol. I'd bought her a snot rag with her initials on it and wrapped it myself. Mom offered, but I said no. It wasn't any lousy 15-cent hanky, either. Those babies were going in the Lewiston J.C. Penney's for 59 cents, and it had lace all the way around the edge. Okay, I grumped at her. Okay, okay, okay. And don't you wise-mouth me, Charlie Decker, she said grimly. Your father is quite capable of thrashing you yet. Don't I know it, I said. Every time we're in the same room together, he reminds me. Charlie... I'm on my way, I said quickly, heading it off. Hang in there, Mom. Don't get dirty, she called after me as I went out the door. Don't spill any ice cream on your pants. Remember to say thank you when you leave. Say hi to Mrs. Granger. I didn't say anything to any of these orders, feeling that to acknowledge might be to encourage. I just jammed the hand that wasn't carrying the package deeper into my pocket and hunched my head. Be a gentleman. God. And remember not to start eating until Carol does. Dear God. I hurried to get out of her sight before she decided to run after me and check to see if I'd peed myself. But it wasn't a day made to feel bad on. The sky was blue and the sun was just warm enough, and there was a little breeze to chase along at your heels. It was summer vacation, and Carol might even give me a tumble. Of course, I don't know just what I'd do if Carol did give me a tumble. Maybe let her ride double on my Schwinn. But I could cross that bridge when I came to it. Perhaps I was even overestimating the negative sex appeal of the corduroy suit. If Carol had a crush on Myron Florin, she was going to love me. Then I saw Joe and started to feel stupid all over again. He was wearing ragged white Levi's and a T-shirt. I could see him looking me up and down, and I winced. The jacket had little brass buttons with a Herald's embossed on them. Rudy Toot. "Great suit," he said. You look just like that guy in the Lawrence Belt show, the one with the accordion. Myron Florin, I said. Right. He offered me a stick of gum, and I skinned it. My mother's idea. I stuck the gum into my mouth. Blackjack gum. There is no finer. I rolled it across my tongue and chomped. I was feeling better again. Joe was a friend, the only good one I ever had. He never seemed afraid of me, or revolted by my weird mannerisms. When a good idea strikes me, for instance, I have a tendency to walk around with my face screwed up in the most god-awful grimaces without even being aware of it. Didn't Grace have a field day with that one? I had Joe beat in the brains department, and he had me in the making friends department. Most kids don't give a hoot in hell for brains. They go a penny a pound. And the kid with the high IQ who can't play baseball or at least come in third in the local circle jerk is everybody's fifth wheel. But Joe liked my brains. He never said, but I know he did. And because everyone liked Joe, they had to at least tolerate me. I won't say I worshipped Joe McKennedy, but it was a close thing. He was my mojo. So there we were, walking along and chewing our blackjack, when a hand came down on my shoulder like a firecracker. I almost choked on my gum. I stumbled, turned around, and there was Dickie Cable. Dickie was a squat kid who always somehow reminded me of a lawnmower, a big Briggs & Stratton self-propelling model with the choke stuck open. He had a big square grin, and it was chock full of big white square teeth that fitted together on the top and bottom like the teeth in two meshing cogs. His teeth seemed to gnash and fume between his lips like revolving mower blades that are moving so fast they seem to stand still. He looked like he ate patrol boys for supper. For all I knew, he did. "Son of a gun, you look slick!" He winked elaborately at Joe. "Son of a gun, you just look slicker than owl shit!" Whack on the back again. I felt very small, about 3 inches, I'd say. I was scared of him. I think I had a dim idea that I might have to fight him or crawfish before the day was over, and that I would probably crawfish. Don't break my back, okay? I said. But he wouldn't leave it alone. He just kept riding and riding until we got to Carol's house. I knew the worst the minute we went through the door. Nobody was dressed up. Carol was there in the middle of the room, and she looked really beautiful. It hurt. She looked beautiful and casual, a shadow glass of sophistication over the just-beginning adolescent. She probably still cried and threw tantrums and locked herself in the bathroom. Probably still listened to Beatles records and had a picture of David Cassidy, who was big that year, tucked into the corner of her vanity mirror. But none of that showed. And the fact that it didn't show hurt me and made me feel dwarfed. She had a rust-colored scarf tied into her hair. She looked 15 or 16, already filling out in front. She was wearing a brown dress. She was laughing with a bunch of kids and gesturing with her hands. Dickie and Joe went on over and gave her their presents, and she laughed and nodded and thank you'd, and my God, but she looked nice. I decided to leave. I didn't want her to see me in my bow tie and my corduroy suit with the little brass buttons. I didn't want to see her talking with Dickie Cable, who looked like a human lawn boy to me, but who seemed to look pretty good to her. I figured I could slip out before anyone got a really good look at me. Like Lamont Cranston, I would just cloud a few minds and then bug out. I had a buck in my pocket from weeding Mrs. Katzen's flower garden the day before, and I could go to the movies in Brunswick if I could hook a ride and work up a good hit of self-pity sitting there in the dark. But before I could even find the doorknob, Mrs. Granger spotted me. It wasn't my day. Imagine a pleated skirt and one of those see-through chiffon blouses on a Sherman tank. A Sherman tank with two gun turrets. Her hair looked like a hurricane, one glump going one way and one glump the other. The two glumps were being held together somehow by a big sateen bow that was poison yellow in color. "Charlie Decker!" she squealed, and spread out arms that looked like loaves of bread. Big loaves. I almost chickened and ran for it. She was an avalanche getting ready to happen. She was every Japanese horror monster ever made, all rolled into one. Ghidra, Mothra, Godzilla, Rodan, and Tukan the Terrible trundling across the Granger living room. But that wasn't the bad part. The bad part was everybody looking at me. You know what I'm talking about. She gave me a slobbery kiss on the cheek and crowed, "Well, don't you look nice?" And for one horribly certain second, I expected her to add, "Slicker than owl shit." Well, I'm not going to torture either you or myself with a blow-by-blow. Where would be the sense? You've got the picture. 3 hours of unadulterated hell. Dickie was right there with a, "Well, don't you look nice," at every opportunity. A couple of other kids happened over to ask me who died. Joe was the only one who stuck by me. But even that embarrassed me a little. I could see him telling kids to lay off, and I didn't like it very well. It made me feel like the village idiot. I think the only one who didn't notice me at all was Carol. It would have bothered me if she had come over and asked me to dance when they put on the records. But it bothered me worse that she didn't. I couldn't dance, but it's the thought that counts. So I stood around while the Beatles sang "The Ballad of John and Yoko" and "Let It Be," while the Edrisi brothers sang "We Gotta Get It On Again," while Bobby Sherman sang "Hey, Mr. Sun" in his superbly tuneless style. I was giving my best imitation of a flower pot. The party, meanwhile, went on, did it ever. It seemed like it was going to go on eternally, the years flashing by outside like leaves in the wind, cars turning into clumps of rust, houses decaying, parents turning into dust, nations rising and falling. I had a feeling that we would still be there when Gabriel flew overhead, clutching the judgment trump in one hand and a party favor in the other. There was ice cream, there was a big cake that said "Happy Birthday, Carol," in green and red icing. There was more dancing, and a couple of kids wanted to play spin the bottle, but Mrs. Granger laughed a big jolly laugh and said, "No, ha ha, no, 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 oh no." Finally, Carol clapped her hands and said we were all going outside and play Follow the Leader, the game which asks the burning question, "Are you ready for tomorrow's society?" Everybody spilled outside. I could hear them running around and having a good time, or whatever passes for a good time when you're part of a mass puberty cramp. I lingered behind for a minute, half thinking Carol would stop for a second, but she hurried right by. I went out and stood on the porch watching. Joe was there, too, sitting with one leg hooked over the porch railing. And we both watched. Somehow, Joe always seems to be where I end up, with one leg hooked over something, watching. "She's stuck up," he said finally. "Nah, she's just busy. A lot of people, you know." "Shit," Joe said. We were quiet for a minute. Someone yelled, "Hey, Joe!" "You'll get crap all over that thing if you play," Joe said. Your mother'll have a kitten.
She'll have two, I said. Come on, Joe.
This time it was Carol. She had changed into denims, probably designed by Edith Head, and she looked flushed and pretty. Joe looked at me. He wanted to look out for me, and suddenly I felt more terrified than at any time since I woke up on that hunting trip up north. After a while, being somebody's responsibility makes them hate you, and I was scared that Joe might hate me someday. I didn't know all that then, not at 12, but I sensed some of it.
Go on, I said.
You sure you don't want to...
Yeah, yeah.
I got to get home anyway. I watched him go, hurt a little that he hadn't offered to come with me, but relieved in a way. Then I started to cross the lawn toward the street. Dickie noticed me.
You on your way, pretty boy?
I should have said something clever like, yeah, give my regards to Broadway. Instead, I told him to shut up. He jackrabbited in front of me, as if he had been expecting it, that big lawnmower grin covering the entire lower half of his face. He smelled green and tough like vines in the jungle.
What was that, pretty boy?
All of it lumped together, and I felt ugly, really ugly. I could have spit at Hitler, that's how ugly I felt. I said, shut up, get out of my way. In the classroom, Carol Granger put her hands over her eyes, but she didn't tell me to stop. I respected her for that. Everybody was staring, but no one was saying anything. Mrs. Granger was in the house singing Swanee at the top of her voice.
Maybe you think you can shut me up.
He ran a hand through his oiled hair. I shoved him aside. It was like being outside myself. It was the first time I ever felt that way. Someone else, some other me, was in the driver's seat. I was along for the ride, and that was all. He swung at me, his fist looped down and hit me on the shoulder. It just about paralyzed the big muscle in my arm. Jesus, did that hurt. It was like getting hit with an ice ball. I grabbed him because I never could box, and shoved him backward across the lawn, that big grin steaming and fuming at me. He dug his heels in and curled an arm around my neck as if about to kiss me. His other fist started hammering at my back, but it was like someone knocking on a door long ago and far away. We tripped over a pink lawn flamingo and whumped to the ground. He was strong, but I was desperate. All of a sudden, beating up Dickie Cable was my mission in life. It was what I had been put on earth for. I remembered the Bible story about Jacob wrestling with the angel, and I giggled crazily into Dickie's face. I was on top and fighting to stay there. But all at once he slid away from me. He was awful slippery, and he smashed me across the neck with one arm. I let out a little cry and went over on my belly. He was astride my back in no time. I tried to turn, but I couldn't. I couldn't. He was going to beat me because I couldn't. It was all senseless and horrible. I wondered where Carol was. Watching, probably. They were all watching. I felt my corduroy coat ripping out under the arms, the buttons with the heralds embossed on them ripping off one by one on the tough loam. But I couldn't turn over. He was laughing. He grabbed my head and slammed it into the ground like a wiffle ball. Hey, pretty boy! Slam! Interior stars and the taste of grass in my mouth. Now I was the lawnmower. Hey, pretty boy, don't you look nice? He picked my head up by the hair and slammed it down again. I started to cry.
Don't you look just dandy?
Dickie Cable cried merrily. And hammered my head into the ground again.
For, don't you just look wonderful?
Then he was off me because Joe had dragged him off.
That's enough, goddammit, he was shouting. Don't you know that's enough?
I got up still crying. There was dirt in my hair. My head didn't hurt enough for me to still be crying, but there it was. I couldn't stop. They were all staring at me with that funny hangdog look kids get when they've gone too far. And I could see they didn't want to look at me and see me crying. They looked at their feet to make sure they were still there. They glanced around at the chain-link fence to make sure no one was stealing it. A few of them glanced over at the swimming pool in the yard next door, just in case someone might be drowning and in need of a quick rescue. Carol was standing there, and she started to take a step forward. Then she looked around to see if anyone else was stepping forward, and no one else was. Dickie Cable was combing his hair. There was no dirt in it. Carol shuffled her feet. The wind made ripples on her blouse. Mrs. Granger had stopped singing Swanee. She was on the porch, her mouth wide open. Joe came up and put a hand on my shoulder. Hey, Charlie, he said. What do you say we go now, huh? I tried to shove him away and only made myself fall down. Leave me alone, I shouted at him. My voice was hoarse and raw. I was sobbing more than yelling. There was only one button left on the corduroy jacket, and it was hanging by a string. The pants were all juiced up with grass stains. I started to crawl around on the matted earth, still crying, picking up buttons. My face was hot. Dickie was humming some spry ditty and looking as if he might like to comb his hair again. Looking back, I have to admire him for it. At least he didn't put on a crocodile face about the whole thing. Mrs. Granger came waddling toward me. Charlie! Charlie, dear!
Shut up, fat old bag! I screamed. I couldn't see anything. It was all blurred in my eyes, and all the faces seemed to be crowding in on me. All the hands seemed to have claws. I couldn't see to pick up any more buttons. Fat old bag! Then I ran away. I stopped behind an empty house down on Willow Street and just sat there until all the tears dried up. There was dried snot underneath my nose. I spat on my handkerchief and wiped it off. I blew my nose. An alley cat came by, and I tried to pet it. The cat shied from my hand. I knew exactly how he felt. The suit was pretty well shot, but I didn't care about that. I didn't even care about my mother, although she would probably call Dickie Cable's mother and complain in her cultured voice. But my father, I could see him sitting, looking, carefully poker-faced, saying, "How does the other guy look?" And my lie. I sat down for the best part of an hour, planning to go down to the highway and stick out my thumb, hook a ride out of town, and never come back. But in the end, I went home. Chapter 23. Outside, a regular cop convention was shaping up. Blue trooper cars, white cruisers from the Lewiston PD, a black and white from Brunswick, two more from Auburn. The police responsible for this automotive cornucopia ran hither and yon, ducked over low. More newsmen showed up. They poked cameras equipped with cobra-like telephoto lenses over the hoods of their vehicles. Sawhorses had been set up on the road above and below the school, along with double rows of those sooty little kerosene pots. To me, those things always looked like the bombs of some cartoon anarchist. The DPW people had put up a detour sign. I guess they didn't have anything more appropriate in stock. Slow madman at work, for instance. Don Grace and good old Tom were hobnobbing with a huge blocky man in the state police uniform. Don seemed almost angry. The big blocky man was listening, but shaking his head. I took him to be Captain Frank Philbrick of the Maine State Police. I wondered if he knew I had a clear shot at him. Carol Granger spoke up in a trembling voice. The shame on her face was alarming. I hadn't told that story to shame her. I was just a kid, Charlie. I know that, I said and smiled. You were awful pretty that day. You sure didn't look like a kid. I had kind of a crush on Dickie Cable, too. After the party and all, she looked even more ashamed. Worse than ever. I went with him to the 8th grade picnic. He seemed, daring, I guess. Wild. At the picnic, he got fresh, and I let him a little. But that was the only time I went anyplace with him. I don't even know where he is now. Placerville Cemetery, Dick Keene said flatly. It gave me a nasty start. It was as if I had just seen the ghost of Mrs. Underwood. I could still have pointed to the places where Dickie had pounded on me. The idea that he was dead made for a strange, almost dreamy terror in my mind. And I saw a reflection of what I was feeling on Carol's face. He got fresh, and I let him a little, she had said. What exactly did that mean to a bright, college-bound girl like Carol? Maybe he had kissed her. Maybe he had even gotten her out into the pucker brush and mapped the virgin territory of her burgeoning chest. At the 8th grade picnic, God save us all. He had been daring and wild. What happened to him? Don Lordy asked. Dick spoke slowly. He got hit by a car. That was really funny. Not ha-ha, you know, but peculiar. He got his driver's license just last October, and he used to drive like a fool, like a crazy man. I guess he wanted everybody to know he had, balls. It got so that no one would ride with him, hardly. He had this 1966 Pontiac, did all the bodywork himself, painted her bottle green with the Ace of Spades on the passenger side. Sure, I used to see that around, Melvin said, over by the Harlow wreck. Put in a Hurst four-shifter all by himself, Dick said. Four-barrel carb, overhead cam, fuel injection. She purred, 90 in second gear. I was with him one night when he went up the Stackpole Road in Harlow at 95. We go around Brissett's Bend and we start to slide. I hit the floor. You're right, Charlie. He looked weird when he was smiling. I don't know if he looked exactly like a lawnmower, but he sure looked weird. He just kept grinning and grinning all the time we were sliding. And he goes, like to himself, he goes, "I can hold her, I can hold her," over and over again. And he did. I made him stop and I walked home. My legs were all rubber. A couple of months later, he got hit by a delivery truck up in Lewiston while he was crossing Lisbon Street. Randy Milliken was with him, and Randy said he wasn't even drunk or stoned. It was the truck driver's fault entirely. He went to jail for 90 days, but Dickie was dead. Funny. Carol looked sick and white. I was afraid she might faint, and so, to take her mind somewhere else, I said, "Was your mother mad at me, Carol?" "Huh?" She looked around in that funny, startled way she had.
I called her a bag, a fat old bag, I think.
Oh.
She wrinkled her nose and then smiled gratefully, I think, picking up on the gambit.
She was. She sure was. She thought that fight was all your fault.
Your mother and my mother used to both be in that club, didn't they?
Books and bridge?
Yeah. Her legs were still uncrossed, and now her knees were apart a little. She laughed.
I'll tell you the truth, Charlie. I never really cared for your mother, even though I only saw her a couple of times to say hi to. My mother was always talking about how dreadfully intelligent Mrs. Decker was, what a very fine grasp she had on the novels of Henry James, stuff like that. And what a fine little gentleman you were.
Slicker than owl shit, I agreed gravely. You know, I used to get the same stuff about you.
You did?
Sure. An idea suddenly rose up and smacked me on the nose. How could I have possibly missed it so long, an old surmiser like me? I laughed with sudden sour delight. And I bet I know why she was so determined I was going to wear my suit. It's called matchmaking, or wouldn't they make a lovely couple, or think of the intelligent offspring. Played by all the best families, Carol. Will you marry me? Carol looked at me with her mouth open. She couldn't seem to finish it.
That's what I think.
She smiled. A little giggle escaped her. Then she laughed right out loud. It seemed a little disrespectful of the dead, but I let it pass. Although, to tell you the truth, Mrs. Underwood was never far from my mind. After all, I was almost standing on her.
That big guy's coming,
Billy Sawyer said. Sure enough, Frank Philbrick was striding toward the school, looking neither right nor left. I hoped the news photographers were getting his good side. Who knew, he might want to use some of the pics on this year's Xmas cards. He walked through the main door. Down the hall, as if in another world, I could hear his vague steps pause, and then go up to the office. It occurred to me in a strange sort of way that he seemed real only inside. Everything beyond the windows was television. They were the show, not me. My classmates felt the same way. It was on their faces. Silence. Chink, the intercom. Decker?
Yes, sir?
I said. He was a heavy breather. You could hear him puffing and blowing into the mic up there like some large and sweaty animal. I don't like that. Never have. My father is like that on the telephone. A lot of heavy breathing in your ears, so you can almost smell the scotch and pell-mells on his breath. It always seems unsanitary and somehow homosexual. This is a very funny situation you've put us all in, Decker.
I guess it is, sir.
We don't particularly like the idea of shooting you.
No, sir, neither do I.
I wouldn't advise you to try.
Heavy breathing.
Okay, let's get it out of the hen house and see what we got in the sack. What's your price?
Price?
I said.
Price?
For one loony moment, I had the impression he had taken me for an interesting piece of talking furniture. A Morris chair, maybe, equipped to huckster the prospective buyer with all sorts of pertinent info. At first, the idea struck me funny. Then it made me mad.
For letting them go. What do you want? Airtime? You got it. Some sort of statement to the papers? You got that.
Snort, snort, snort.
Likewise, puff, puff, puff.
But let's do it and get it done before this thing turns into a hairball. But you got to tell us what you want.
You,
I said. The breath stopped. Then it started again, puffing and blowing. It was starting to really get on my nerves.
You'll have to explain that, he said.
Certainly, sir,
I said. We can make a deal.
Would you like to make a deal? Is that what you were saying?
No answer, puff, snort. Philbrick was on the 6 o'clock news every Memorial Day and Labor Day, reading a please drive safely message off the teleprompter with a certain lumbering ineptitude that was fascinating and almost endearing. I had felt there was something familiar about him, something intimate that smacked of deja vu. Now I could place it. The breathing. Even on TV, he sounded like a bull getting ready to mount Farmer Brown's cow in the back 40.
What's your deal?
Tell me something first, I said. Is there anybody out there who thinks I might just decide to see how many people I can plug down here? Like Don Grace, for instance?
That piece of shit, Sylvia said, then clapped a hand over her mouth.
Who said that?
Philbrick barked.
Sylvia went white.
Me,
I said. I have certain transsexual tendencies too, sir. I didn't figure he would know what that meant and would be too wary to ask.
Could you answer my question?
Some people think you might go the rest of the way out of your gourd, yes, he answered weightily. Somebody at the back of the room tittered. I don't think the intercom picked it up.
Okay, then, I said. The deal is this. You be the hero. Come down here, unarmed. Come inside with your hands on your head. I'll let everybody go, then I'll blow your fucking head off, sir. How's that for a deal? You buy it?
Puff, snort, blow. You got a dirty mouth, fella. There are girls down there, young girls. Irma Bates looked around, startled, as if someone had just called her.
The deal, I said. The deal.
No, Philbrick said. You'd shoot me and hold on to the hostages.
Puff, snort.
But I'll come down. Maybe we can figure something out.
Fella, I said patiently, if you sign off and I don't see you going out the same door you came in within 15 seconds, someone in here is just going to swirl down the spout.
Nobody looked particularly worried at the thought of just swirling down the spout.
Puff, puff.
Your chances of getting out of this alive are getting slimmer.
Frank, my man, none of us get out of it alive. Even my old man knows that.
Will you come out?
No.
If that's how you feel. He didn't seem upset. There's a boy named Jones down there. I want to speak with him. It seemed okay.
You're on, Ted, I told him.
Your big chance, boy. Don't blow it. Folks, this kid is going to dance his balls off before your very eyes.
Ted was looking earnestly at the black grating of the intercom.
This is Ted Jones, sir.
On him, sir, sounded good.
Is everyone down there still all right, Jones?
Yes, sir.
How do you judge Decker's stability?
I think he's apt to do anything, sir, he said, looking directly at me. There was a savage leer in his eyes.
Carol looked suddenly angry. She opened her mouth as if to refute, and then, perhaps remembering her upcoming responsibilities as valedictorian and leading lamp of the Western world, she closed her mouth with a snap.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Ted looked absurdly pleased at being called Mr.
Decker?
Right here.
Snort, snort.
Be seeing you.
I better see you, I said. 15 seconds.
Then, as an afterthought, Philbrick?
Yeah.
You've got a shitty habit, you know it. I've noticed it on all those TV drive safely pitches that you do. You breathe in people's ears. You sound like a stallion in heat, Philbrick. That's a shitty habit. You also sound like you're reading off a teleprompter even when you're not. You ought to take care of stuff like that. You might save a life.
Philbrick puffed and snorted thoughtfully. Screw, buddy, he said, and the intercom clicked off.
Exactly 12 seconds later, he came out the front door, striding stolidly along. When he got to the cars that had been driven onto the lawn, there was another conference. Philbrick gestured a lot.
Nobody said anything.
Pat Fitzgerald was chewing a fingernail thoughtfully. Pigpen had taken out another pencil and was studying it, and Sandra Cross was looking at me steadily. There seemed to be a kind of mist between us that made her glow.
What about sex? Carol said suddenly.
And when everyone looked at her, she colored.
Male, Melvin said, and a couple of the jocks in the back of the room haw-hawed.
What do you mean? I asked.
Carol looked very much as if she wished her mouth had been stitched closed.
I thought when someone started to act, well, you know, strangely.
She stopped in confusion, but Susan Brooks sprang to the ramparts.
That's right, she said. And you all ought to stop grinning. Everyone thinks sex is so dirty. That's half what's the matter with all of us. We worry about it.
She looked protectively at Carol.
That's what I meant, Carol said. Are you... well, did you have some bad experience?
Nothing since that time I went to bed with Mom, I said blandly.
An expression of utter shock struck her face, and then she saw I was joking.
Pigpen snickered dolefully and went on looking at his pencil.
No, really, she said.
Well, I said, frowning. I'll tell about my sex life if you'll tell about yours.
Oh.
She looked shocked again, but in a pleasant way.
Gracie Stanner laughed.
Cough up, Carol.
I had always gotten a murky impression that there was no love lost between those two girls, but now Grace seemed genuinely to be joking, as if some understood but never mentioned inequality had been erased.
Ray, Ray, Corky Harold said, grinning.
Carol was blushing furiously.
I'm sorry I asked.
Go on, Don Lordy said.
It won't hurt.
Everybody would tell, Carol said. I know the way people talk around.
Secrets, Mike Gavin whispered hoarsely. Give me more secrets.
Everybody laughed, but it was getting to be no laughing matter.
You're not being fair, Susan Brooks said.
That's right, I said. Let's drop it.
Oh, never mind, Carol said. I'll talk. I'll tell you something.
It was my turn to be surprised.
Everybody looked at her expectantly. I didn't really know what they expected to hear. A bad case of penis envy, maybe, or 10 nights with a candle.
I figured they were in for a disappointment, whatever it was. No whips, no chains, no night sweats. Small-town virgin, fresh, bright, pretty, and someday maybe she would blow Placerville and have a real life. Sometimes they change in college.
Some of them discover existentialism and anime and hash pipes.
Sometimes they only join sororities and continue with the same sweet dream that began in junior high school. A dream so common to the pretty small-town virgins that it almost could have been cut from a simplicity pattern, like a jumper or a your yummy summer blouse or play skirt. There's a whammy on bright girls and boys. If the bright ones have a twisted fiber, it shows. If they don't, you can figure them as easily as square roots. Girls like Carol have a steady boyfriend and enjoy a little necking, but as the tubes say, don't touch me there. Nothing overboard. It's okay, I guess. You'd expect more, but so sorry, please, there just isn't. Bright kids are like TV dinners. That's all right. I don't carry a big stick on that particular subject. Smart girls are just sort of dull. And Carol Granger had that image. She went steady with Buck Thorne, the perfect American name. Buck was the center of the Placerville High Greyhounds, which had posted an 11-0 record the previous fall, a fact that Coach Bob Stoneballs Stoneham made much of at our frequent school spirit assemblies. Thorne was a good-natured shit who weighed in at a cool 210. Not exactly the brightest thing on 2 feet, but college material, of course. And Carol probably had no trouble keeping him in line. I've noticed that pretty girls make the best lion tamers, too. Besides, I always had an idea that Buck Thorne thought the sexiest thing in the world was a quarterback sneak right at the middle. I'm a virgin, Carol said defiantly, startling me up out of my thoughts. She crossed her legs as if to prove it symbolically, then abruptly uncrossed them. And I don't think it's so bad, either. Being a virgin is like being bright. It is, Grace Stanner asked doubtfully. You have to work at it, Carol said. That's what I meant, you have to work at it. The idea seemed to please her. It scared the hell out of me. You mean Buck never... Oh, he used to want to. I suppose he still does. But I made things pretty clear to him early in the game. And I'm not frigid or anything, or a Puritan. It's just that... She trailed off, searching. You wouldn't want to get pregnant, I said. No, she said almost contemptuously. I know all about that. With something like shock, I realized she was angry. And upset because she was. Anger is a very difficult emotion for a programmed adolescent to handle. I don't live in books all the time. I read all about birth control and... She bit her lip as the contradiction of what she was saying struck her. Well, I said. I tapped the stock of the pistol lightly on the desk blotter. This is serious, Carol. Very serious. I think a girl should know why she's a virgin, don't you?
I know why.
Oh, I nodded helpfully. Several girls were looking at her with interest. Because... Silence. Faintly, the sound of Jerry Kesserling using his whistle to direct traffic. Because... She looked around. Several of them flinched and looked down at their desks. Just then, I would have given my house and lot, as the old farmers say, to know just how many virgins we had in here. And you don't all have to stare at me. I didn't ask you to stare at me. I'm not going to talk about it. I don't have to talk about it. She looked at me bitterly. People tear you down, that's it. They grind you if you let them, just like Pigpen said. They all want to pull you down to their level and make you dirty. Look at what they are doing to you, Charlie. I wasn't sure they had done anything to me just yet, but I kept my mouth shut. I was walking along Congress Street in Portland just before Christmas last year. I was with Donna Taylor. We were buying Christmas presents. I just bought my sister a scarf in Porteous Mitchell, and we were talking about it and laughing. Just silly stuff. We were giggling. It was about 4 o'clock and just starting to get dark. It was snowing. All the colored lights were on, and the shop windows were full of glitter and packages. Pretty. And there was one of those Salvation Army Santa Clauses on the corner by Jones's bookshop. He was ringing his bell and smiling. I felt good. I felt really good. It was like the Christmas spirit and all that. I was thinking about getting home and having hot chocolate with whipped cream on top of it. And then this old car drove by, and whoever was driving cranked his window down and yelled, "Hi, cunt!" And Lasky jumped. I have to admit that the word did sound awfully funny coming out of Carol Granger's mouth. "Just like that," she said bitterly. "It was all wrecked. Spoiled. Like an apple you thought was good and then bit into a wormhole. Hi, cunt." As if that was all there was. No person, just a huh. Her mouth pulled down in a trembling, agonized grimace.
And that's like being bright, too. They want to stuff things into your head until it's all filled up. It's a different hole, that's all. That's all.
Sandra Cross's eyes were half-closed, as if she dreamed.
You know, she said, I feel funny.
I wanted to jump up and tell her to keep her mouth shut, tell her not to incriminate herself in this fool's parade, but I couldn't. Repeat, couldn't. If I didn't play by my rules, who would?
I feel like this is all, she said. Either all brains or all cunt, Carol said with brittle good humor.
Doesn't leave room for much else, does it?
Sometimes, Sandra said, I feel very empty.
Carol began and then looked at Sandra, startled.
You do?
Sure. She looked thoughtfully out the broken windows. I like to hang out clothes on windy days. Sometimes that's all I feel like, a sheet on the line. You try to get interested in things, politics, the school. I was on the student council last semester. But it's not real, and it's awfully dull. And there aren't a lot of minorities or anything around here to fight for, or, well, you know, important things. And so I let Ted do that to me. I looked carefully at Ted, who was looking at Sandra with his face frozen. A great blackness began to drizzle down on me. I felt my throat close.
It wasn't so hot, Sandra said. I don't know what all the shouting's about. It's...
She looked at me, her eyes widening, but I could hardly see her. But I could see Ted. He was very clear. In fact, he seemed to be lit by a strange golden glow that stood out in the new clotted darkness like a halo, a supernormal aura. I raised the pistol very carefully in both hands. For a moment I thought about the inner caves of my body, the living machines that run on and on in the endless dark. I was going to shoot him, but they shot me first. Chapter 24. I know what happened now, although I didn't then. They had the best sharpshooter in the state out there, a state policeman named Daniel Malvern from Kent's Hill. There was a picture of him in the Lewiston Sun after everything was all over. He was a small man with a crew cut. He looked like an accountant. They had given him a huge Mauser with a telescopic sight. Daniel Malvern took the Mauser to a gravel pit several miles away, test-fired it, and then brought it back and walked down to one of the cruisers parked on the lawn with the rifle stuffed down his pants leg. He rested in the prone position behind the front fender in deep shadow. He gauged the windage with a wet thumb. Nil. He peered through the telescopic sight. Through the 30-power cross-hatched lens, I must have looked as big as a bulldozer. There was not even any window glass to throw a glare, because I had broken it earlier when I fired the pistol to make them stop using the bullhorn. An easy shot. But Dan Malvern took his time. After all, it was probably the most important shot of his life. I was not a clay pigeon. My guts were going to splatter all over the blackboard behind me when the bullet made its mushrooming exit. Crime does not pay. Looney bites the dust. And when I half rose, half leaned over Mrs. Underwood's desk to put a bullet in Ted Jones, Dan's big chance came. My body half twisted toward him. He fired his weapon and put the bullet exactly where he had hoped and expected to put it, through my breast pocket, which lay directly over the living machine of my heart, where it struck the hard steel of Titus, the helpful padlock. Chapter 25. I held on to the pistol. The impact of the slug knocked me straight backward against the blackboard, where the chalk ledge bit cruelly into my back. Both of my Cordovan loafers flew off. I hit the floor on my fanny. I didn't know what had happened. There was too much all at once. A huge auger of pain drilled my chest, followed by sudden numbness. The ability to breathe stopped. Spots flashed in front of my eyes. Irma Bates was screaming. Her eyes were closed, her fists were clenched, and her face was a hectic, patched red with effort. It was far away and dreamy, coming from a mountain or a tunnel. Ted Jones was getting out of his seat again, floating really, in a slow and dreamy motion. This time he was going for the door. They got the son of a bitch. His voice sounded incredibly slow and draggy, like a 78 RPM record turned down to 33 and a third. They got the crazy. Sit down. He didn't hear me. I wasn't surprised. I could hardly hear myself. I didn't have any wind to talk with. He was reaching for the doorknob when I fired the pistol. The bullet slammed into the wood beside his head, and he shied away. When he turned around, his face was a stew of changing emotions, white astonishment, agonized unbelief, and twisted, murdering hate. You can't. You're... Sit down. A little better. Perhaps 6 seconds had gone by since I had been knocked on my ass. Stop yelling, Irma.
You're shot, Charlie,
Grace Stanner said calmly. I looked outside. The cops were rushing the building. I fired twice and made myself breathe. The auger struck again, threatening to explode my chest with pain.
Get back! I'll shoot them!
Frank Philbrick stopped and looked around wildly. He seemed to want a telephone call from Jesus. He looked confused enough to try and carry on with it, so I fired again up in the air. It was his turn to go 100 miles in his head during half a second.
Get back, he yelled. Get the Christ back.
They retreated, getting back even quicker than they had gotten down. Ted Jones was edging toward me. That boy was simply not part of the real universe. Do you want me to shoot your weenie off? I asked. He stopped, but that terrifying, twisted expression was still on his face. You're dead, he hissed. Lie down, goddamn you. Sit down, Ted. The pain in my chest was a live thing, horrible. The left side of my ribcage felt as if it had been struck by Maxwell's silver hammer. They were staring at me, my captive class, with expressions of preoccupied horror. I didn't dare look down at myself because of what I might see. The clock said 10:55.
Decker!
Sit down, Ted. He lifted his lip in an unconscious facial gesture that made him look like a slat-sided hound that I had seen lying mortally wounded beside a busy street when I was just a kid. He thought about it, and then he sat down. He had a good set of sweat circles started under his armpits.
Decker! Mr. Denver is going up to the office.
It was Philbrick on the bullhorn, and not even the asexual sexuality of the amplification could hide how badly he was shaken up. An hour before it would have pleased me, fulfilled me in a savage way, but now I felt nothing.
He wants to talk to you.
Tom walked out from behind one of the police cars and started across the lawn, walking slowly, as if he expected to be shot at any second. Even at a distance, he looked 10 years older. Not even that could please me. Not even that. I got up a little at a time, fighting the pain, and stepped into my loafers. I almost fell and had to clutch the desk with my free hand for support.
Oh, Charlie,
Sylvia moaned. I fully loaded the pistol again, this time keeping it pointed toward them. I don't think even Ted knew it couldn't be fired with the clip sprung. Doing it slowly so I could put off looking down at myself for as long as possible. My chest throbbed and ached. Sandra Cross seemed lost again in whatever fuzzy dream it was that she contemplated. The clip snapped back into place, and I looked down at myself almost casually. I was wearing a neat blue shirt. I've always been fond of solid colors. And I expected to see it matted with my blood, but it wasn't. There was a large dark hole, dead center through my breast pocket, which was on the left. An uneven scattering of smaller holes radiated out from all around it, like one of those solar system maps that show the planets going around the sun. I reached inside the pocket very carefully. That was when I remembered Titus, whom I had rescued from the wastebasket. I pulled him out very carefully. The class went, ah, as if I had just sawed a lady in half or pulled a $100 bill out of Pigpen's nose. None of them asked why I was carrying my combination lock in my pocket. I was glad. Ted was looking at Titus bitterly, and suddenly I was very angry at Ted, and I wondered how he would like to eat poor old Titus for his lunch. The bullet had smashed through the hard, high-density plastic dial, sending high-speed bits of shrapnel out through my shirt. Not one of them had touched my flesh. The steel behind the face had caught the slug, had turned it into a deadly lead blossom with 3 bright petals. The whole lock was twisted as if by fire. The semicircular lock bar had been pulled like taffy. The backside of the lock had bulged, but not broken through. Footnote. It was 1.5 years later when I saw that commercial on TV for the first time. The one where the guy with the rifle takes aim at the padlock nailed to the board. You even get a look through the telescopic sight at the padlock. Yale, a master, I don't know which. The guy pulls the trigger, and you see that lock jump and dent and mash. And it looked in that commercial just the way old Titus looked when I took him out of my pocket. They show it happening in regular motion, and then they show it in slow motion.
And the first and only time I saw it, I leaned down between my legs and puked between my ankles. They took me over there, Charlie. Want to talk about it? But I couldn't talk about it. I've never been able to talk about it until now. End of footnote.
Chink
on the intercom. Charlie? Just a minute, Tom. Don't rush me. Charlie, you have to.
Shut the fuck up!
I unbuttoned my shirt and opened it. The glass went, ah, again. Titus was imprinted on my chest in angry purple, and the flesh had been mashed into an indentation that looked deep enough to hold water. I didn't like to look at it, any more than I liked to look at the old drunk with the bag of flesh below his nose, the one that always hung around Gogan's downtown. It made me feel nauseated. I closed my shirt.
Tom, those bastards tried to shoot me.
They didn't mean...
Don't tell me what they didn't mean to do,
I screamed at him. There was a crazy note in my voice that made me feel even sicker.
You get your old cracked ass out there and tell that motherfucker Philbrick he almost had a bloodbath down here. Have you got it?
Charlie, he was whining.
Shut up, Tom. I'm through fooling with you. I'm in the driver's seat, not you. Not Philbrick, not the superintendent of schools, not God. Have you got it?
Charlie, let me explain.
Have you got it?
Yes, but...
All right, we've got that straight. So you go back and give him a message, Tom. Tell him that I don't want to see him or anyone else out there make a move during the next hour. No one is going to come in and talk on this goddamn intercom, and no one else is going to try and shoot me. At noon, I want to talk to Philbrick again. Can you remember all that, Tom?
Yes, Charlie.
All right, Charlie.
He sounded relieved and foolish. They just wanted me to tell you it was a mistake, Charlie. Somebody's gun went off by accident, and...
One other thing, Tom. Very important.
What, Charlie?
You need to know where you stand with that guy Philbrick, Tom. He gave you a shovel and told you to walk behind the ox cart, and you're doing it. I gave him a chance to put his ass on the line, and he wouldn't do it. Wake up, Tom. Assert yourself.
Charlie, you have to understand what a terrible position you're putting us all in.
Get out, Tom.
He clicked off. We all watched him come out through the main doors and start back toward the cars. Philbrick came over to him and put a hand on his arm. Tom shook it off. A lot of the kids smiled at that. I was past smiling. I wanted to be home in my bed and dreaming all of this. Sandra, I said. I believe you were telling us about your affaire de coeur with Ted. Ted threw a dark glance at me. You don't want to say anything, Sandy. He's just trying to make all of us look dirty like he is. He's sick and full of germs. Don't let him infect you with what he's got. She smiled. She was really radiant when she smiled like a child. I felt a bitter nostalgia, not for her exactly, or for any imagined purity, Dale Evans panties and all that, but for something I could not precisely put my hand on. Her, maybe. Whatever it was, it made me feel ashamed. But I want to, she said. I want to get it on, too. I always have. It was 11 o'clock on the nose. The activity outside seemed to have died. I was sitting well back from the windows now. I thought Philbrick would give me my hour. He wouldn't dare do anything else now. I felt better, the pain in my chest receding a little. But my head felt very strange, as if my brains were running without coolant and overheating like a big hot rod engine in the desert. At times I was almost tempted to feel, foolish conceit, that I was holding them myself by sheer willpower. Now I know, of course, that nothing could have been further from the truth. I had one real hostage that day, and his name was Ted Jones.
We just did it, Sandra said, looking down at her desk and tracing the engravings there with a shaped thumbnail.
I could see the part in her hair. She parted it on the side like a boy. Ted asked me to go to the Wonderland dance with him, and I said I would. I had a new formal. She looked at me reproachfully.
You never asked me, Charlie.
Could it be that I was shot in the padlock only 10 minutes ago? I had an insane urge to ask them if it had really happened. How strange they all were.
So we went to that. And afterward, we went to the Hawaiian hut.
Ted knows the man who runs it and got us cocktails, just like the grown-ups. It was hard to tell if there was sarcasm in her voice or not. Ted's face was carefully blank, but the others were looking at him as if they were seeing a strange bug. Here was a kid, one of their own, who knew the man who runs it. Corky Harold was obviously chewing it and not liking it.
I didn't think I'd like the drinks because everybody says liquor tastes horrible at first, but I did. I had a gin fizz and it tickled my nose. She looked pensively in front of her. There were little straws in it, red ones, and I didn't know if you drank through them or just stirred your drink with them until Ted told me. It was a very nice time. Ted talked about how nice it was playing golf at Poland Springs. He said he'd take me sometime and teach me the game if I wanted. Ted was curling and uncurling his lip again, dog-like. He wasn't, you know, fresh or anything. He kissed me goodnight, though, and he wasn't a bit nervous about it. Some boys are just miserable all the way home, wondering if they should try to kiss you goodnight or not. I always kissed them, just so they wouldn't feel bad. If they were yucky, I just pretended I was licking a letter. I remembered the first time I took Sandy Cross out to the regular Saturday night dance at the high school. I had been miserable all the way home, wondering if I should kiss her goodnight or not. I finally didn't. After that, we went out 3 more times. Ted was very nice. He could always think of funny things to say, but he never told dirty jokes or anything, you know, like that. We did some necking, and that was all. Then I didn't see him to go out with for a long time, not until this April. He asked me if I wanted to go to the Rollerdrome in Lewiston. I had wanted to ask her to go to the Wonderland dance with me, but I hadn't dared. Joe, who always got dates when he wanted them, kept saying, "Why don't you?" And I kept getting more nervous and kept telling him to fuck off. Finally, I got up the stuff to call our house, but I had to hang up the telephone after one ring and run to the bathroom and throw up. As I've told you, my stomach is bad. We were having a pretty blah time when all of a sudden these kids got into an argument on the middle of the floor, Sandra said. Harlow boys and Lewiston boys, I think. Anyway, a big fight started. Some of them were fighting on their roller skates, but most of them had taken them off. The man who runs it came out and said if they didn't stop, he was going to close. People were getting bloody noses and skating around and kicking people that had fallen down and punching and yelling horrible things. And all the time, the jukebox was turned up real loud, playing Rolling Stones music. She paused and then went on. Ted and I were standing in one corner of the floor by the bandstand. They have live music on Saturday nights, you know. This one boy skated by wearing a black jacket. He had long hair and pimples. He laughed and waved at Ted when he went by and yelled, "Fuck her, buddy, I did." And Ted just reached out and popped him upside the head. The kid went skating right into the middle part of the rink and tripped over some kid's shoes and fell on his head. Anyway, Ted was looking at me and his eyes were, you know, almost bugging out of his head. He was grinning. You know, that's really the only time I ever really saw Ted grin like he was having a good time. Ted goes to me, "I'll be right back," and he walks across the rink to that inside part where the kid who said that was still getting up. Ted grabbed him by the back of the jacket and, I don't know, started to yank him back and forth, and the kid couldn't turn around, and Ted just kept yanking him back and forth, and that kid's head was bouncing, and then his jacket ripped right down the middle. And he goes, "I'll kill you for ripping my best jacket, you MF." So Ted hit him again, and the kid fell down, and Ted threw the piece of his jacket he was holding right down on top of him. Then he came back to where I was standing, and we left. We drove out into Auburn to a gravel pit he knew about. It was on that road to Lost Valley, I think. Then we did it, in the back seat. She was tracing the graffiti on her desk again. It didn't hurt very much. I thought it would, but it didn't. It was nice. She sounded as if she were discussing a Walt Disney feature film, one of those with all the cute little animals. Only this one was starring Ted Jones as the bald-headed woodchuck. He didn't use one of those things like he said he would, but I didn't get pregnant or anything. Slow red was beginning to creep out of the collar of Ted's khaki army shirt, spreading up his neck and over his cheeks. His face remained fumingly expressionless. Sandra's hands made slow, languorous gestures. I suddenly knew that her natural habitat would be in a porch hammock at the very August height of summer, temperature 92 in the shade, reading a book, or perhaps just staring out at the heat shimmer rising over the road, a can of 7-Up beside her with an elbow straw in it, dressed in cool white short shorts and a brief halter with the straps pushed down, small diamonds of sweat stippled across the upper swell of her breasts and her lower stomach. He apologized afterward. He acted uncomfortable, and I felt a little bad for him. He kept saying he would marry me if, you know, if I got preggers. He was really upset. And I go, "Well, let's not buy trouble, Teddy." And he goes, "Don't call me that. It's a baby name." I think he was surprised I did it with him. And I didn't get preggers. There just didn't seem to be that much to it.
Sometimes I feel like a doll, not really real, you know what? I fix my hair, and every now and then I have to hem a skirt, or maybe I have to babysit the kids when Mom and Dad go out. And it all just seems very fake, like I could peek behind the living room wall and it would be cardboard, with the director and the cameraman getting ready for the next scene. Like the grass and the sky were painted on canvas flats. Fake. She looked at me earnestly. Did you ever feel like that, Charlie? I thought about it very carefully. No, I said. I can't remember that ever crossing my mind, Sandy. It crossed mine, even more after with Ted. But I didn't get pregnant or anything. I used to think every girl got pregnant the first time, without fail. I tried to imagine what it would be like, telling my parents. My father would get real mad and want to know who the son of a bee was, and my mother would cry and say, I thought we raised you right. That would have been real. But after a while, I stopped thinking about that. I couldn't even remember exactly what it felt like, having him, well, inside me. So I went back to the roller drum. The room was totally silent. Never in her wildest dreams could Mrs. Underwood have hoped to command such attention as Sandra Cross commanded now. His boy picked me up. I let him pick me up. Her eyes had picked up a strange sparkle. I wore my shortest skirt, my powder blue one, and a thin blouse. Later on, we went out back, and that seemed real. He wasn't polite at all. He was sort of jerky. I didn't know him at all. I kept thinking that maybe he was one of those sex maniacs, that he might have a knife, that he might make me take dope, or that I might get pregnant. I felt alive. Ted Jones had finally turned and was looking at Sandra with an almost woodcut expression of horror and dead revulsion. It all seemed like a dream,
something out of Le Moyen-Age, a dark passion play.
That was Saturday night, and the band was playing. You could hear it out in the parking lot, but kind of faint. The roller drum doesn't look like much from the back, just all boxes and crates piled up, and trash cans full of Coke bottles. I was scared, but I was excited, too. He was breathing really fast and holding onto my wrist tight, as if he expected me to try to get away. Ted made a horrid gagging sound. It was hard to believe that anyone in my peer group could be touched so painfully by anything other than the death of a parent. Again, I admired him. He had an old black car, and it made me think of how my mother used to tell me when I was just little that sometimes strange men want you to get in the car with them, and you should never do it. That excited me, too. I can remember thinking, what if he kidnaps me and takes me to some old shack in the country and holds me for ransom? He opened the back door, and I got in. He started to kiss me. His mouth was all greasy, like he'd been eating pizza. They sell pizza inside for 20 cents a slice. He started to feel me up, and I could see he was smudging pizza on my blouse. Then we were lying down, and I pulled my skirt up for him. Shut up! Ted cried out with savage suddenness. He brought both fists crashing down on his desk, and everybody jumped. You rotten whore! You can't tell that in front of people! Shut your mouth, or I'll shut it for you! You shut up, Teddy, or I'll knock your teeth down your fucking throat, Dick Keene said coldly. You got yours, didn't you? Ted gaped at him. The two of them shot a lot of fool together down at the Harlow wreck and sometimes went cruising in Ted's car. I wondered if they would be hanging out together when this was all over. I had my doubts. He didn't smell very nice, Sandra continued, as if there had been no interruption at all. But he was hard and bigger than Ted. Not circumcised, either. I remember that. It looked like a plum when he pushed it out of, you know, his foreskin. I thought it might hurt, even, though I wasn't a virgin anymore. I thought the police might come and arrest us. I knew they walked through the parking lot to make sure no one was stealing hubcaps or anything. And a funny thing started to happen inside me before he even got my pants down. I never felt anything so good, or so real. She swallowed. Her face was flushed. He touched me with his hand, and I went, just like that. And the funny thing was, he didn't even get to do it. He was trying to get it in, and I was trying to help him, and it kept rubbing against my leg, and all of a sudden, you know. And he just laid there on top of me for a minute, and then he said in my ear, "You little bitch, you did that on purpose." And that was all. She shook her head vaguely. But it was very real. I can remember everything. The music, the way he smiled, the sound his zipper made when he opened it, Everything. She smiled at me, that strange, dreamy smile. But this has been better, Charlie. And the strange thing was, I couldn't tell if I felt sick or not. I didn't think I did, but it was really too close to call. I guess when you turn off the main road, you have to be prepared to see some funny houses. How do people know they're real? I muttered. What, Charlie? Nothing. I looked at them very carefully. They didn't look sick, any of them. There was a healthy sheen on every eye. There was something in me, maybe it came over on the Mayflower, that wanted to know, how could she let that be on the walls of herself? How could she say that? But there was nothing in the faces that I saw to echo that thought. There would have been in Philbrick's face, in good old Tom's face. Probably not in Don Grace's, but he would have been thinking it. Secretly, all the evening news shows notwithstanding, I'd held the belief that things change, but people don't. It was something of a horror to begin realizing that all those years I'd been playing baseball on a soccer field. Pigpen was still studying the bitter lines of his pencil. Susan Brooks only looked sweetly sympathetic. Dick Keene had a half-interested, half-lustful expression on his face. Corky's head was furrowed and frowning as he wrestled with it. Gracie looked slightly surprised, but that was all. Irma Bates merely looked vapid. I don't think she had recovered from seeing me shot. Were the lives of all our elders so plain that Sandy's story would have made lurid reading for them? Or were all of theirs so strange and full of terrifying mental foliage that their classmates' sexual adventure was on a level with winning a pinball replay? I didn't want to think about it. I was in no position to be reviewing moral implications. Only Ted looked sick and horrified, and he no longer counted. I don't know what's going to happen, Carol Granger said, mildly worried. She looked around. I'm afraid all of this changes things. I don't like it. She looked at me accusingly. I liked the way things were going, Charlie. I don't want things to change after this is over. Heh, I said. But that kind of comment had no power over the situation. Things had gotten out of control. There was no real way that could be denied anymore. I had a sudden urge to laugh at all of them, to point out that I had started out as the main attraction, and had ended up as the sideshow. I have to go to the bathroom, Irma Bates said suddenly. Hold it, I said. Sylvia laughed. Turnabout is fair play, I said. I promised to tell you about my sex life. In all actuality, there isn't very much to tell about unless you read palms. However, there is one little story which you might find interesting. Sarah Pastern yawned, and I felt a sudden excruciating urge to blow her head off. But number two must try harder, as they say in the rent-a-car ads. Some cats drive faster, but Decker vacuums all the psychic cigarette butts from the ashtrays of your mind. I was suddenly reminded of that Beatles song that starts off, I read the news today, oh boy. I told them. Chapter 26 In the summer before my junior year at Placerville, Joe and I drove up to Bangor to spend a weekend with Joe's brother, who had a summer job working for the Bangor Sanitation Department. Pete McKennedy was 21. A fantastic age, it seemed to me. I was struggling through the open sewer that is 17, and going to the University of Maine, where he was majoring in English. It looked like it was going to be a great weekend. On Friday night, I got drunk for the first time in my life, along with Pete and Joe and one or two of Pete's friends, and I wasn't even very hungover the next day. Pete didn't work Saturdays, so he took us up to the campus and showed us around. It's really very pretty up there in summer. Although on a Saturday in July, there weren't many pretty co-eds to look at. He told us that most of the summer students took off for Bar Harbor or Clear Lake on weekends. We were just getting ready to go back to Pete's place when he saw a guy he knew slouching down toward the steam plant parking lot. Scrag! He yelled. Hey, Scrag! Scrag was a big guy wearing paint-splattered faded jeans and a blue work shirt. He had a drooping sand-colored mustache and was smoking an evil-looking little black cigar that he later identified as the original Smoky Perote. It smelled like slowly burning underwear. How's it hanging? He asked. Up a foot, Pete said. This is my brother Joe and his buddy Charlie Decker, he introduced. Scrag Simpson. Howdy doody,
Scrag said, shaking hands and dismissing us.
What you doing tonight, Peter?
Thought the three of us might go to a movie.
Don't do that, Pete,
Scrag said with a grin.
Don't do that, baby.
What's better?
Pete asked, also grinning.
Dana Collette's throwing a party at this camp her folks own out near Scudic Point. There's going to be about 40 million unattached ladies there. Bring dope.
Does Larry Moeller have any grass? Pete asked.
Last I knew, he had a shitload. Foreign, domestic, local, everything but filter tips.
Pete nodded.
We'll be there, unless the creek rises. Scrag nodded and waved a hand as he prepared to resume his version of that ever-popular form of campus locomotion, the undergraduate slouch. Meet you, he said to Joe and me. We went down to see Jerry Moeller, who Pete said was the biggest dope dealer in the Orono Old Town Stillwater Triangle. I kept my cool about it, as if I were one of the original Placerville Jones men, but privately I was excited and pretty apprehensive. As I remember it, I sort of expected to see Jerry sitting naked on the john with a piece of rubber flex tied off below his elbow and a hypo dangling from the big forearm vein, and watching the rise and fall of ancient Atlantis in his navel. He had a small apartment in Old Town, which borders the campus on one side. Old Town is a small city with three distinctions: its paper mill, its canoe factory, and 12 of the roughest honky-tonks in this great smiling country. It also has an encampment of real reservation Indians, and most of them look at you as if wondering how much hair you might have growing out of your asshole and whether or not it would be worth scalping. Jerry turned out to be not an ominous Jones man type, holding court amid the reek of incense and Ravi Shankar music, but a small guy with a constant wedge-of-lemon grin. He was fully clothed and in his right mind. His only ornament was a bright yellow button, which bore the message, "Goldilocks loved it." Instead of Ravi and his incredible boinging sitar, he had a large collection of bluegrass music. When I saw his Greenbrier Boys albums, I asked him if he'd ever heard the Tar Brothers. I've always been a country and bluegrass nut. After that, we were off. Pete and Joe just sat around looking bored until Jerry produced what looked like a small cigarette wrapped in brown paper.
"You want to light it?" he asked Pete.
Pete lit it. The smell was pungent, almost tart, and very pleasant. He drew it deep, held the smoke, and passed the J on to Joe, who coughed most of it out. Jerry turned back to me. "You ever heard the Clinch Mountain Boys?" I shook my head. "Heard of them, though." "You gotta listen to this," he said. "Boy, is it horny." He put an LP with a weird label on the stereo. The J came around to me. "You smoke cigarettes?" Jerry asked me paternally. I shook my head. "Then draw slow or you'll lose it." I drew slow. The smoke was sweet, rather heavy, acrid, dry. I held my breath and passed the J on to Jerry. The Clinch Mountain Boys started in on Blue Ridge Breakdown. Half an hour later, we had progressed through two more joints and were listening to Flat and Scruggs charge through a little number called Rushin' Around. I was about ready to ask when I should start feeling stoned when I realized I could actually visualize the banjo chords in my mind. They were bright, like long steel threads, and shuttling back and forth like looms. They were moving rapidly, but I could follow them if I concentrated deeply. I tried to tell Joe about it, but he only looked at me in a puzzled, fuzzy way. We both laughed. Pete was looking at a picture of Niagara Falls on the wall very closely. We ended up sticking around until almost 5 o'clock, and when we left, I was wrecked out of my mind. Pete bought an ounce of grass from Jerry, and we took off for Scudic. Jerry stood in the doorway of his apartment and waved goodbye and yelled for me to come back and bring some of my records. That's the last really happy time I can remember. It was a long drive down to the coast. All three of us were still very high, and although Pete had no trouble driving, none of us could seem to talk without getting the giggles. I remember asking Pete once what this Dana Collette, who was throwing the party, looked like, and he just leered. That made me laugh until I thought my stomach was going to explode. I could still hear bluegrass playing in my head. Pete had been to a party out there in the spring, and we only took one wrong turn finding it. It was at the end of a narrow mile of gravel marked Private Road. You could hear the heavy bass signature of the music a quarter mile from the cabin. There were so many cars stacked up that we had to walk from just about that point. Pete parked and we got out. I was starting to feel unsure of myself and self-conscious again. Partly the residue of the pot, and partly just me. Worried about how young and stupid I would probably look to all these college people. Jerry Moeller had to be 1 in 100. I decided I would just stick close to Joe and keep my mouth closed. As it turned out, I could have saved the worry. The place was packed to the rafters with what seemed like 1 million people. Every one of them drunk, stoned, or both. The smell of marijuana hung on the air like a heavy mist, along with wine and hot bods. The place was a babble of conversation, loud rock music, and laughter. There were 2 lights dangling from the ceiling, 1 red, 1 blue. That rounds off the first impression the place gave me. It was like the fun house at Old Orchard Beach. Scrag waved at us from across the room.
Pete!
Someone squealed almost in my ear. I jerked and almost swallowed my tongue. It was a short, almost pretty girl with bleached hair and the shortest dress I had ever seen. It was a bright fluorescent orange that looked almost alive in the weird lighting. Hi, Dana! Pete shouted over the noise. This is my brother Joe and one of his buddies, Charlie Decker. She said hi to both of us. Isn't it a great party? She asked me. When she moved, the hem of her dress swirled around the lace bottoms of her panties. I said it was a great party. Did you bring any goodies, Pete? Pete grinned and held up his baggie of weed. Her eyes sparkled. She was standing next to me, her hip pressed casually against mine. I could feel her bare thigh. I began to get as horny as a bull moose. Bring it over here, she said. We found a relatively unoccupied corner behind one of the stereo speakers, and Dana produced a huge scrolled water pipe from a low bookshelf that was fairly groaning with Hesse, Tolkien, and Reader's Digest condensed books. The latter belonged to the parents, I assumed. We toked up. The grass was much smoother in the water pipe, and I could hold the smoke better. I began to get very high indeed. My head was filling up with helium. People came and went. Introductions, which I promptly forgot, were made. The thing that I liked best about the introductions was that every time a stray wandered by, Dana would bounce up to grab him or her. And when she did, I could look straight up her dress to where the heavenly home was sheathed in the gauziest of blue nylon. People changed records. I watched them come and go, some of them undoubtedly talking of Michelangelo or Ted Kennedy or Kurt Vonnegut. A woman asked me if I had read Susan Brownmiller's Women Rapists. I said no. She told me it was very tight. She crossed her fingers in front of her eyes to show me how tight it was, and then wandered off. I watched the fluorescent poster on the far wall, which showed a guy in a t-shirt sitting in front of a TV. The guy's eyeballs were slowly dripping down his cheeks, and there was a big cheese-eating grin on his face. The poster said, "Shit, Friday night and I'm stoned again." I watched Dana cross and uncross her legs. A few filaments of pubic hair, 9 shades darker than the bleach job, had strayed out of the lacy leg bands. I don't think I have ever been that horny. I doubt if I will ever be that horny again. I had an organ which felt large enough and long enough to pole vault on. I began to wonder if the male sex organ can explode. She turned to me and suddenly whispered in my ear. My stomach heated up 20 degrees instantly, as if I had been eating chili. A moment before, she had been talking to Pete and to some joker I remembered being non-introduced to. Then she was whispering in my ear, her breath tickling the dark channel. "Go on out the back door," she said. "There." She pointed. It was hard to comprehend, so I just followed her finger. Yes, there was the door. The door was real, and the door was earnest. It had 1 hell of a knob on it. I chuckled, convinced that I had just thought a particularly witty thought. She laughed lightly in my ear and said, "You've been looking up my dress all night. What does that mean?" And before I could say anything, she kissed my cheek softly and gave me a little shove to get me going. I looked around for Joe, but I didn't see him anyplace. "Sorry, Joe." I got up and heard both my knees pop. My legs were stiff from sitting in the same position so long. I had an urge to untuck my shirt and cover up the huge bulge in my jeans. I had an urge to tiptoe across the room. I had an urge to cackle wildly and announce to the general attendance that Charles Everett Decker earnestly believed that he was about to get screwed, that, to drop a bad pun, Charles Everett Decker was about to rip off his maiden piece. I didn't do any of those things. I went out the back door. I was so stoned and so horny that I almost fell 20 feet to the tiny white shingle of beach that was down below. The back of the cabin overlooked a sudden rocky drop to a postage stamp inlet. A flight of weather-washed steps led down. I walked carefully, holding on to the railing.
My feet felt 1,000 miles away. The music sounded distant on this side, blending and almost being covered by the rhythmic sound of the waves. There was a slip of a moon and a ghost of a breeze. The scene was so frozenly beautiful that for a moment I thought I had walked into a black-and-white picture postcard. The cabin behind and above was only a dim blur. The trees climbed on both sides, pines and spruces that sloped off to naked rock headland, twin spurs of it, which cupped the crescent-shaped beach where the waves licked. Straight ahead was the Atlantic, pinpointed with uncertain nets of light from the moon. I could see the faintest curve of an island far out to the left, and wondered who walked there that night besides the wind. It was a lonesome thought, and it made me shiver a little. To continue, turn the cassette over.